So it's my pleasure to give the opening talk for this conference, and I'm going to be talking about our experiments on condensates of pairs of fermionic atoms, and this is work done at JILA in Boulder, Colorado. And since this is the first talk, I'm going to spend quite a bit of the talk on introduction to motivation and telling you a little bit of my view of these experiments. So I'll talk about the so-called BCS-BEC crossover problem, why ultra-cold gas experiments are sort of uniquely suited to studying this problem, and then a little bit about the Feshbach resonance, the tool that we use in these experiments, and then I'll tell you about our experiments on fermionic condensates. So first, let me review ways that you might think about making condensates when you're starting with a gas of fermions, in our case, fermionic atoms. So first of all, you can imagine if I have fermionic atoms, say, in two internal states, spin up and spin down, I could pair two together, chemically bond them together into a diatomic molecule. That diatomic molecule will, of course, be a boson, and those bosons could then undergo condensation at low enough temperature. And so I've shown that schematically as these diatomic molecules all in a single quantum state, lowest motional state of our trap potential. There's a much more subtle thing that can go on that also involves pairing of fermions that condense. And this is a phenomenon that we know very well from condensed matter physics, so-called BCS theory of superconductivity. So in this case, you really have to look at fermions as fermions, put them in your quantized energy states of your trap, as shown here in a Fermi-C, satisfying the Pauli exclusion principle. And then pairing really only occurs near the Fermi energy. So most of the atoms are down here, locked below in the Fermi-C, but the excitations at finite temperature up here are removed by pairing those fermionic atoms into Cooper pairs, and those Cooper pairs are simultaneously condensed. Now, we usually don't think of these pairs in the same way as molecules. In fact, we often think of it as pairing in momentum space rather than pairing in real space, as shown here. In fact, I can't draw pairing in momentum space, so I just blurred out the Fermi surface here. However, these two phenomena, we believe, are connected. And not only are they connected, but that one can imagine that as a function of a single parameter, for example, the interaction strength that drives this pairing in either of these pictures, that you could tune a system between these two limits, that these are two limits of the same phenomena, and this is the viewpoint of the BCS-BEC crossover theories. So if you want to access this crossover, what you need to do is to have a system where you can control the interactions and try to make the interactions that cause this Cooper pairing stronger and stronger going toward this limit. So if we can look experimentally at these two limits on a single plot, and this is a plot taken from a theory paper by Murray Holland at JILA, and this is just putting BCS phenomena, so these are low-temperature superconductors, things like niobium, on the same plot as Bose-Einstein condensation phenomena. So to do this, I have to generalize the idea of a Fermi temperature, but we can do that. It has to do with the spacing of energy levels, mass of the particle, etc. And then on the x-axis, I'm plotting the energy, the binding energy up here, or the gap energy. So it's the energy cost to break a fermion pair. And on the y-axis is the transition temperature to your superfluid or superconductor. And both of these are normalized by the Fermi temperature or Fermi energy. So you see, to put BCS and BEC phenomena in the same plot, I need a plot that spans more than 15 orders of magnitude in the gap or binding energy, and more than what looks like 7 orders of magnitude in the transition temperature. So down here in the BCS theory, we know that the pairing happens simultaneously with the condensation, and so you have a transition temperature and a pairing energy that are both both related, and they're both something like 10 to the minus 4 times the Fermi energy or Fermi temperature. In this limit on Bose-Einstein condensation, I've just defined the gap as the energy cost to pull off a fermion, so in that case, the last electron, for example, in rubidium-87. And you see up here you have binding energies that are 10 orders of magnitude larger than condensation energy. So this is a system where the Fermi degree of freedom really is irrelevant. And consequently, transition temperature is independent of that.
you just plot TF for like a helium atom, how do you define that?
It really just has to do with the density of particles. It's a measure of the quantum degeneracy. It's just to show you how much space there is between these two phenomena in orders of magnitude and binding energy and transition temperature. And then I can put on here a few experimental examples of things that are not in these two limits. These are things that, for example, high temperature superconductors that are not well described by the BCS theory nor Bose-Einstein condensation. And we're going to be looking at, in these quantum gas experiments, in a region roughly marked by this green square. This is also the region Murray was looking at theoretically. So we're interested in really the crossover between these two limits, where you are in neither of these limits, in the region where the theory is not well understood, where the gap energy is of order, maybe within an order of magnitude of the Fermi energy, and the transition temperatures are a sizable fraction of the Fermi temperature. So this is a region that has been explored theoretically for a number of decades, with the basic idea being that you would predict that there could be a smooth connection as a function of some tuning parameter that measures the interaction strength. There'd be a smooth connection between the well-understood BCS theory and the well-understood limit of Bose-Einstein condensation. So I want to show a couple of theory plots to give you a feel of the picture of what happens in this region. So first of all, let me show transition temperature, again normalized by Fermi temperature. And now on this axis is my tuning parameter. So it's a measure of the interaction strength. It's given by the scattering length A. And in crossover theories, one typically sees this dimensionless parameter, 1 over KFA, where KF is the Fermi wave vector. So in this plot, when I have large positive 1 over KFA, that would correspond to the BEC limit, somewhere way off here. And large negative 1 over KFA, way over here, would be the BCS limit. And what the theories find, so here's an example of this black line showing how one might connect smoothly in the transition temperature between the BCS limit and the BEC limit. One thing that's surprising that comes out of these theories is that the crossover, the connection between BCS and BEC occurs over a fairly narrow range of 1 over KFA. Strictly speaking, the BCS theory is only valid way far off the left side of my plot, where 1 over KFA is much, much greater than 1. However, in the theories, you see the deviation from that prediction or the BEC limit really only occur over a narrow range of 1 over KFA. I also showed on the previous plot the gap. So this is again, taken from another crossover theory paper showing the gap over the Fermi energy as a function of this tuning parameter. Again, you see a similar thing. The black line is the crossover theory. The deviations from the BCS and the BEC limit really occur around 1 over K of 0, strong interacting regime, and in a fairly narrow range. Okay, so now I want to talk about the experiments, and in particular why the quantum gas experiments really have this new unique tool, the Feshbach resonance, that allows us to access this crossover. So first of all, let me describe the experiments very briefly. We do a three-stage cooling process to cool a gas of fermionic atoms. In our experiments in Boulder, we're using potassium-40. So we start with laser cooling and trapping, starting from a room temperature gas. We then put the atoms into a magnetic potential and do evaporative cooling. And as shown here, typically in our experiments, we have atoms in two internal states, labeled here as spin 1 and spin 2, and shown in the two colors. Our last bit of cooling is done in an optical trapping potential. So we transfer the atoms from this magnetic trap into this far detuned optical dipole trap. This has advantages for the experiment, where we want to use magnetic field as a knob to tune the interactions. So we don't really want a magnetic trap. That's a little bit inconvenient. So we use an optical trapping potential. We can now apply any magnetic field, and we have a confinement that's independent of what the magnetic moment of the atoms is. Okay, so then to take data, what we do to look at this gas is time of flight absorption imaging. So we suddenly turn off the trap. The gas then falls and expands. And after some tens of milliseconds, we take a picture of this expanded gas by shining a pulse of resonant laser light at the gas. The atoms absorb photons from this beam, and we image the shadow cast in the beam on a digital CCD camera. So this is a picture of the velocity distribution of the atoms. Since atoms that had high velocity get to the edges here, atoms with low velocity stay near the center. The false color just tells you how much absorption. That's our way of counting how many atoms. So white and red would be a lot of absorption, a lot of atoms near the center here. So this is a snapshot of the velocity or momentum distribution. So this is very nice for a condensate. If you want to see a condensate that's a bunch of particles near zero velocity in the lowest energy motional state of your trap, that would show up as a spike of atoms near the center of the cloud. However, we don't start with bosons, we start with fermions, so we don't have such a nice signature of quantum degeneracy. But I can show you here pictures of these time of flight resonant absorption images of our Fermi gas at fairly low T over TF. So what we're looking for now for the Fermi gas is this kind of arrangement, where you're obeying the Pauli exclusion principle, stacking up the particles, one per state, or in our case two, since we have two spin states. So to see this arrangement in these images is, again, not as obvious as a condensate, but what I can do is I can draw for you on each of these three temperature plots, I can draw a circle in black that corresponds to the Fermi energy, or maybe more accurately, the Fermi velocity in these velocity distributions. So the Fermi energy is just defined as the energy of the highest filled state at T equals zero. So it just to know the Fermi energy, you just need to know the spacing of levels in your trap, in our case, a harmonic trap, and the number of particles, since you're stacking them up until you run out of particles. So with just the number of particles and knowledge of the trap, we can draw this black circle, and you see that as we go lower in temperature, more and more particles lie below this Fermi energy. Obviously, at T equals zero, everything would be inside this black circle. Here at 10% of the Fermi temperature, we see still some excitations above the Fermi energy.
Yeah. When we construct this transport, do we assume ballistic extension?
Yes. So in practice, what we're really doing is we're fitting the distribution to the Thomas Fermi profile for an ideal gas of fermions, yeah. So this data is all taken well away from the Feshbach resonance where the interactions are weak. Okay, so the point is from data like this, we can extract things like T over T Fermi. Okay, so we have a quantum degenerate gas of fermions, but the thing that's really unique is that we have a handle on the interactions. So in this very cold gas, the interactions are characterized by a single parameter. It has units of length. It's called the S-wave scattering length. The sign of this scattering length, A, tells you whether the interactions are effectively repulsive. This means that it would cost you energy to pile the atoms in at higher density, or effectively attractive, meaning that there's an energy gain if you can pile in the atoms at higher density. And the magnitude of the scattering length tells you how strong the interactions are. The thing in these ultra-cold gases is we now have this new tool where we can actually control this scattering length. And for example, we could make the scattering length very large. So this means as large as it can be for a gas that has finite kinetic energy. And we can also make the interactions attractive. Now, strong attractive interactions is just where you want to be if you want to explore this BCS-BEC crossover, because these attractive interactions could drive something like Cooper pairs, but now generalized to very strong interactions. The way that we do this in the experiments is through what's called a magnetic field Feshbach resonance. It's a scattering resonance. And the tuning parameter experimentally, the knob that we use, is the magnetic field. So that's increasing in this direction. At some magic value of the magnetic field, shown here is this, in this red dotted line, that's the Feshbach resonance. At that magic value, what happens is a new bound state appears in the potential felt by the two atoms. That bound state appears exactly at the same energy of two free atoms. And then as you move away from the Feshbach resonance, that bound state moves deeper into the potential. So this is the binding energy now of this new molecular state that enters right at the Feshbach resonance. So shown schematically up here is a cartoon picture of what's happening to the potential. In green is the potential felt by two atoms as they scatter as a function of the internuclear separation, R. Over here, we have a bound state below threshold by some distance. As we move close to the Feshbach resonance, that bound state moves very close to threshold until it moves actually out, and we now have a virtual state just above threshold, and then it moves further away as we move away from the resonance. So it turns out that the scattering length, it depends very sensitively on where this last bound state is. So if I plot the scattering length on this same cartoon picture in blue, we see the scattering length becomes quite large in magnitude right around this Feshbach resonance value of the magnetic field. So this large magnitude is going to mean very strong interactions. On this side of the Feshbach resonance, where we don't have the two-body bound state, we have very large attractive interactions, or negative scattering length. So we have a system where we could start with a weakly interacting Fermi gas. We could turn on the interactions, make them very strong and attractive to drive some kind of generalized Cooper pairing. We could also cross the Feshbach resonance and actually make diatomic molecules, which could then condense. So I want to show you now that this cartoon is not just a cartoon, but we actually have data on these things in experiments. We can measure, for example, the scattering length. So this is a measurement with RF spectroscopy where we're looking at the energy cost to put atoms in at higher densities, the so-called mean field energy shift. This is proportional to scattering length, so we can extract scattering length from this as a function of magnetic field. In this case, there was a Feshbach resonance at about 224 Gauss. You see, again, the magnitude of the scattering length increase right near the resonance, and we see on one side of the resonance these strong attractive interactions that could be used for driving Cooper pairing.
Can you tell a little more about what the measurement is, just a little, or should I ask afterwards?
Maybe ask afterwards. It's RF spectroscopy, where we're really looking at an energy shift in an RF Zeeman transition, and that energy shift is coming from these interactions.
This would be the loop case of not giving many body effects, like an expanding power.
This is not a very low temperature, so it's T over TF might be of order 1, but there could be many body effects in here. The black line is the two-body theory, and you can see we agree with the two-body theory actually until you get very close to resonance. But when very close to resonance, I think there are important many-body shifts. Okay, so the other thing I showed you on the cartoon was the binding energy of this new molecule state that appears at the Feshbach resonance. Here's some data where we've measured that. This is the energy on this axis measuring the energy splitting between this new molecule state and the energy of two free atoms as a function of magnetic field. This is the same Feshbach resonance I showed before. So the Feshbach resonance, shown by the black dotted line now, is at about 224 Gauss. On the left side of the Feshbach resonance, we see the appearance of this new bound state, very close to threshold, again moves deeper into the potential as we move away from resonance. This was measured with an RF photodissociation technique, where we created a bunch of molecules, and then we looked at the energy cost to break those molecules into free atoms. Now there's several things we've learned in the experiments about these molecules that are important for the fermionic condensate work. One is that we can create large numbers of these molecules simply by sweeping the magnetic field from above the resonance to below, and we've seen as high as 90% conversion in our potassium-40 atoms into molecules. Another thing which you can see from this plot is these molecules are extremely weakly bound. We're measuring binding energies in units of kilohertz, so binding energies of several hundred kilohertz down to tens of kilohertz. For comparison, in chemistry, one normally thinks of the weakest bound molecular dimer to be the helium dimer. That the helium dimer has a binding energy of something like 10 megahertz. So these are extremely weakly bound from any standard. Now, we might have a different standard in these experiments, however, because we also have an extremely low temperature gas. So one can ask, when is this binding energy comparable to the kinetic energy in the gas, for example, the Fermi energy? That actually only happens very close to resonance, so somewhere within, certainly within 1 Gauss, but maybe more like half a Gauss of the resonance, is where the binding energy predicted by the two-body theory, which you see matches our data quite well, would start to be comparable to the Fermi energy. This is the same as saying that the two-body prediction of the molecule size would be larger than the, or comparable to the spacing between your atoms. So this would be a very interesting regime. And in fact, that's basically a description of what starts to happen in the regime of the BCS-BEC crossover. Okay, a final comment on these molecules is that even though they're incredibly weakly bound, we see that they can survive many collisions. This is some data where we've measured the decay rate of these molecules as a function of magnetic field, now plotted in terms of the detuning from the Feshbach resonance here at zero. This is the fraction of the molecule that decays in 1 millisecond. A few Gauss away from the resonance, we see that all of the molecules have decayed in about a millisecond time scale. This means that the molecules are being killed in every collision. Well, this isn't too surprising since you have these extremely fragile, weakly bound molecules. However, what's surprising is that we see when we go close to the Feshbach resonance, the molecules actually become larger, more weakly bound, and yet the decay rate drops orders of magnitude to the point where we're losing less than 1% of the sample in a millisecond. Now, a millisecond, again, is roughly the time scale for collisions or motion in the trap. So this means that the molecules are surviving many collisions. It means we can do experiments with the system in thermal equilibrium. So this is obviously important for studying the crossover. I should say that this was predicted by this theory paper, and there have been a number of other experiments seeing these long-lived molecules. Okay, so let me go back to now the cartoon picture of the Feshbach resonance, where I've showed you we can map out this bound state as well as the scattering length, and now use this as a starting point for looking at the VCS-BEC crossover. So what we want to do is to turn a Fermi gas into a molecular condensate. That's the starting experiment. And this is using the fact we can control the interactions, but not only can we control them, but we can do this in real time. Right, so we're going to take our gas that we've cooled down to some low T over T Fermi. We're going to start it out over here where we have very weak interactions. We can measure the temperature and expansion without having to worry about many-body effects. And now we're simply going to vary the magnetic field in real time, lowering it, going all the way across the Feshbach resonance and stopping over here where we expect to have diatomic molecules that could Bose condense. So let me first describe what's going to happen as we vary the time scale of this magnetic sweep, and then a few slides later I'll show you the data where we've seen these effects. So first of all, you can imagine if I ramp very quickly, ramp the magnetic fields very swiftly across the resonance, the atoms have no time to feel the resonance. So what's going to happen is I'm just going to end up over here with the same gas of fermionic atoms. They just haven't seen this molecule state, and it's going to be some finite temperature Fermi C. If I go somewhat slower, that rate is going to be given by something about the nature of the Feshbach resonance, then I'll end up with molecules. So now I'll have swept atoms from free atoms down to this new lower energy two-body state, the molecules. And I'll get molecules. Now notice at this sweep speed, what we'll see experimentally is that the molecules will have a kinetic energy distribution that's comparable to the Fermi energy. So now we want to ask the question, what happens if we go even slower? So now we imagine we go some 100 times slower in our magnetic field sweep, and here we're going to see we can get a condensate. So the basic idea of what happens in this very slow sweep was proposed in a couple papers, but the idea is that you have a time-dependent magnetic field. You vary that field extremely slowly such that as the atoms cross the Feshbach resonance and get converted into molecules, there are many collisions between atoms and molecules, thermalizing the gas, such that what you're conserving as you go across here is not energy, but really entropy. So this is an adiabatic sweep where entropy is conserved. Well, if I have a bunch of fermionic atoms, the lowest entropy configuration is this T equals 0, 1, this perfect Fermi C. Over here, if I have bosonic molecules, the lowest entropy configuration is a condensate. So of course, the experiments are going to be a finite temperature Fermi C and a finite condensate fraction. So this is data where we saw the molecular condensate. These are pictures starting with two different initial temperatures. These are pictures of the velocity distribution of the molecules. So we release the gas, as I showed before, and we image selectively only the molecules that we've created. This is basically uses our RF photodissociation technique. So we dissociate the molecules after expansion, selectively imaging only molecules. And we see this characteristic condensate spike. So this bunch of molecules near zero velocity, they're in the lowest quantum state of our system. These are just showing cross sections where you can see more clearly that there's a condensate fraction. There's also a thermal tail of non-condensed molecules in our sample. This is just a two-component fit. So it was a Gaussian plus a parabola. So from these fits, we can extract things like the fraction of the molecules that are in the condensate. So this was starting with a Fermi gas, again, measured away from the Feshbach resonance at T over TF of 0.06. Again, we just swept the magnetic field in real time. We did no direct cooling of the molecules, and yet we end up with this condensate. So one can ask, if you start at a higher T over TF, so in this case about 0.2, now you have a higher entropy configuration. When we sweep, we end up with no condensate, and this would be consistent with the higher entropy, giving you a higher entropy molecule system. This is some data showing you what I talked about briefly, the time scales for these experiments. So this is just looking at, you have a magnetic field sweep from high to low crossing the Feshbach resonance. I'm varying the sweep speed. It's plotted in inverse units, so zero is the fastest sweep. Larger numbers are slower sweeps. So if we cross the Feshbach resonance with only a few microseconds to cross one Gauss, again, we see that the atoms simply don't have time to see the fact that this new bound state comes in, and they stay in the high energy state. If we go slower, and the time scale experimentally determined is something like 40 microseconds to cross one Gauss, then we start to see conversion of a large fraction of the sample into molecules. And we get the full molecule conversion at something on the order of 40 microseconds per Gauss. So we go longer, and the number of molecules we get doesn't increase. So what happens, if we want to look at what happens when we go even slower, we have to look at not the molecules, but what's the kinetic energy of those molecules, or what's their velocity distribution. So we see at something like 40 microseconds per Gauss, where we get the full number of molecules, we actually have no condensate. This is starting with a low T over TF cloud. But if we go slower and slower, we start to see a condensate appear in the molecules we create until we get the full condensate fraction at something like 4,000 microseconds to cross one Gauss. So what this tells us is there are two timescales in the problem. These two timescales are separated by two orders of magnitude. So the first timescale here for the two-body physics, to take two atoms and stick them into a molecule state, that takes, that has a timescale of like 40 microseconds per Gauss. But to have the many-body system evolve, again, having many collisions between atoms and molecules to hopefully conserve entropy and create a condensate, that takes some 4,000 microseconds per Gauss. So I'm emphasizing this because it's important for our later experiments, where instead of looking at a condensate of molecules, we want to look at a Fermi condensate. And what I mean by that is something over here. So we want to start again with our low-temperature Fermi gas, far from the Feshbach resonance, lower the magnetic field in real time at this slow rate that allows many collisions, hopefully conserving entropy. But now stop this sweep before we cross the Feshbach resonance and ask, do we have a condensate there? And now a condensate of pairs of fermionic atoms where there's no two-body bound state. So we have strong attractive interaction that could drive this pairing. The difficulty is not to enter this regime, but to observe what's happening there. So if we just looked at the atoms here, we expand the gas, we look at the atoms, we see what looks like a finite temperature Fermi C. So this isn't very surprising, since if we're looking for condensation, we really need to be looking at pairs and not individual fermions. So to look at the pairs, we add a second probe sweep. So after this slow sweep in close to the resonance, we release the gas from the trap. So the trap, and simultaneously with the trap turnoff, we do this fast field sweep across the Feshbach resonance. It's done at a sweep speed that will convert most of the sample. Something like 60% of the sample will get converted into molecules, regardless of where we start this fast sweep. But this fast sweep was too fast to create a condensate when we swept from far away from the resonance. So the idea is to have the slow entropy conserving or adiabatic sweep here, and then convert to molecules and look at what happens. So what we're looking for is not the molecule number, because that's going to be constant, but really the velocity distribution of those molecules, whether we have a condensate or not. This is the data. We see that we do see a condensate when we stop the slow sweep on the side of the Feshbach resonance where there's no two-body bound state. So this is a measure at low density of where the two-body bound state exists. So over here, there's no molecules, no two-body bound state. Nonetheless, over here, we can see a condensate. Moving further away, a smaller condensate, and the molecules created by the fast probe sweep. And we have to go something about like half a Gauss away to see no condensate after this slow sweep. This is data plotting the condensate fraction instead of the picture. So these are just from these two component fits. So N0 is the number of molecules that are in the condensate peak, the spike near zero velocity. N is the total number of molecules. Again, N is not changing as we change where we stop the slow field sweep. Only N0 is changing. So here, the Feshbach resonance, again, is in these units is at zero. The dotted lines indicate our uncertainty in where the molecule, two-body molecule state disappears. So over here, there is a two-body molecule state. On this side, there is not. Nonetheless, we can see significant condensate fraction on that side of the Feshbach resonance. This must be a condensate of pairs of fermionic atoms where there doesn't exist a two-body bound state. And let me emphasize again, if we start far from the resonance, we don't see this condensate. So if we do the slow magnetic field sweep but stop more than half a Gauss away from the resonance, the fast probe sweep doesn't show any condensate. The red data are just, again, examining the probe, the role of the probe sweep. So in this, for the red points, we made the probe sweep 10 times faster. So it's something like 4 microseconds per Gauss of that order. We're reducing the number of molecules we create because we're starting to go too fast for the two-body physics. Nonetheless, we see that the condensate fraction exactly matches the data taken for 40 microseconds per Gauss. So this indicates that the probe sweep is not playing a significant role in the creation of this condensate, but rather we have a condensate on the side of the Feshbach resonance before doing the probe sweep, and that's what gives us this signal. So we can map out a phase diagram now by varying two parameters, the initial temperature measured in units of the Fermi temperature. It's always measured at the weakly interacting case. Then after the sweep, we can vary where we stop this slow sweep, and we can plot that in units of scattering length. And look at, again, the condensate fraction and the molecules created by the fast probe sweep. So this is the phase diagram, T over TF in this axis. Now I've plotted our data in these same dimensionless units used in the crossover theories. So 1 over KFA, where KF is the Fermi wave vector, A is the scattering length. The Feshbach resonance is at 0 in these units. Now the left and right have been swapped just because of the nature of our Feshbach resonance. So now on the right side is where we have molecules. So over here is where we have the two-body molecule state. On the left side of this plot is where you have atoms, and very far on the left side would be the BCS limit. The false color here tell you how much condensate fraction we measure with this technique, the highest condensate fraction being red and orange. Again, we see lots of condensate even when we're on the side of the resonance where we know the two-body bound state doesn't exist. So this indicates condensation that must involve many body effects, the pairing of fermionic atoms. We also see condensates very close to the Feshbach resonance on the side where there is a two-body bound state. One shouldn't really think of condensates in this region as just trivial Bose-Einstein condensation because, again, when we get very close to the Feshbach resonance, the two-body prediction is going to put that molecule size larger than the spacing between our particles. So the crossover is really occurring on both sides of this Feshbach resonance. The dotted line here is just the BCS theory, not expected to be valid if you believe there's a smooth connection, that is a crossover. This BCS theory can't be valid since it diverges. Nonetheless, it's sort of a landmark to show you where our data lie. And as most crossover theories would predict, we lie below this diverging BCS prediction for the transition temperature. Note also that our data is consistent with higher transition temperatures as we go closer to the Feshbach resonance, and this would be predicted by most crossover theories as well. I just want to make a couple comments on what kind of things might be happening in this crossover region. So I have lists here of sort of what happens in the BCS limit and what happens in the BEC limit. And again, the guiding principle is you believe that there's a smooth connection, and then as a function of this tuning parameter, so looking at the two limits kind of gives you an idea of what's going to happen in between in the crossover. In red are the things that we sort of touch on this experiment. We touch on whether the pairs, the composite bosons that condense, are a collective many-body effect or whether it's a two-body effect. We just touch on this because we know over here there are two-body diatomic molecules. We can't really say that the pairing here are exactly those two-body molecules. In fact, in some region close to the resonance, that must not be true. And over here, we know that we have a many-body effect because the two-body physics says there is no, two-body experiments say there are no molecules over here. Note also that the language is Cooper pairs over here and diatomic molecules over there, but in fact, in the crossover, they're really neither and both. Okay, so the other thing we sort of touch on a little bit is the transition temperature. One expects in the BCS limit, again, transition temperatures tend to be like 10 to the minus 4 times the Fermi temperature. We see transition temperatures about 10 to the minus 1 times. So we're somewhere in between these two limits. And finally, I think a very interesting thing that we don't touch on here is what happens to the normal state, or in other words, the excitations above the condensate. Are you starting with a Fermi gas? Are you starting with a Bose gas? Or something in between? This will be interesting to explore. Let me conclude there. I hope I've convinced you that the atomic Fermi gas these days, these experiments are really providing access now to the BCS-BEC crossover region, the region that's been explored theoretically. In particular, I told you about our experiments today where we've taken a Fermi gas and just converted it in real time into molecular condensate, as well as condensates of pairs of fermionic atoms where there's no two-body bound state. So this is something like Cooper pairs, but with very strong interactions. We've also showed you we can make condensates with molecules, but with their two-body prediction of the molecule, binding energy would be less than the condensation energy. Obviously, there are many opportunities, and we'll hear a number of interesting things later in the conference on further experimental and theoretical work on these systems. With that, let me acknowledge the members of the group that have actually been in the lab taking this data, their postdoc Marcus Greiner, and graduate student Cindy Riegel. And Cindy is also at the conference this week. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for that great introduction and wonderful data. Are there comments or questions?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
David, and can you say something about the density profile of the cloud when you observe condensation of fermionic pairs for negative scattering length or infinite scattering length?
So we have not done measurements of the density profile, which would be in-trap measurements. All our data has been taken in expansion. We have looked at the expansion, so basically the velocity profile of the atoms in this region of the condensate. It looks like a finite temperature Fermi C. It fits well to that functional form.
Okay. Yeah, I have a question about your imaging method. When you do your sweeps, the fast sweeps or slow sweeps, do you see any difference in the line shape of your spectroscopy? Or do you just look at the frequency that you know you should see molecules?
So you're talking about if we do optical absorption imaging, do we?
So when you jump to the molecular side, you break up your molecules using this pulse, and this RF pulse, right? And nominally, some of your early papers, you actually show this line shape for, I believe it was after a slow sweep. And in principle, this is a direct measure of the atomic density states. That's what you're doing. And you're seeing the density states at this lower energy than in the free gas because you have this molecular state there, right? And so when you do your RF pulse at that detuned frequency to try and break up the molecules, to probe what the molecules are, I'm just wondering if the line shape changes, which would imply maybe you're not, it would be very interesting if somehow the system wasn't described exactly by these, this delta function of molecules bound it there, and that somehow the faster sweep might give you some strange out of equilibrium structure.
So we have not seen any change in the photodissociation line shapes as a function of sweep speed. I should say that most of our data where we want to take an image of the molecules, and so we apply some frequency to dissociate them right before imaging, that the that frequency is always well shifted from threshold, and so I wouldn't expect to see any of these effects.
Thank you.
Could you remind me of your aspect ratio, and could you make a comment on the temperature you extract from your data if you look at either the radial or the axial expansion? You get the same temperature.
So our aspect ratio is something like 70, axial obviously being weaker than the radial. We have taken our temperatures from the radial direction, where in the expansion you get into the momentum regimes, and not from the axial direction. Comparing the temperature in the axial direction and the radial direction is made difficult by the fact that the trap is not harmonic. It has strong anharmonicity in the axial direction, so that would complicate any interpretation of the momentum distribution to get a temperature.
Yes, but means
you measure effect density. Yes, that's true.
So what do you learn from that?
So we have not seen, again, any change in the density profile other than it looks like a finite temperature Fermi distribution. So the Fermi distribution is the same in spatial or momentum, and we see that functional form fit well in both directions.
So you're saying that from the density distribution, the axial direction, you extract the same temperature as you get from the momentum distribution?
Let me be a little more careful. In practice, what we do is we do surface fits, where we fit simultaneously only with a single parameter that would tell us T over TF. We haven't done cross-sectional fits in different directions to really see if they would be different.
But
my question is very much related to Hugh's one, because you draw this circle on your time of flight distribution, so this circle is not really a velocity, a pure velocity distribution. It
no.
is only in the radial one. So.
Yes.
So then the language, because the expansion of the Fermi gas should be isotropic in momentum space, right?
Oh, yes.
So,
yes.
So this circle is a memory of the initial position distribution along the weak axis, and the temperature information is only in the radial direction. That's
yes.
what you said.
The pictures I showed with the circle were not radial pictures. A lot of our data on the condensate are radial pictures. Yes and no. So our functional form has an extra parameter. So we the widths can be different, and the two directions are unconstrained to be related. We fit this basically fugacity we use as a free parameter. That fugacity is this shape, basically distortion from a Gaussian. In practice, is what it's measuring, and that we use as only a single parameter.
I guess you gave us good reason to believe from your earlier experiments that the sweep rates which you use in the most recent experiments are too fast for a truly adiabatic analysis to be applicable, in other words, a constant entropy analysis. But have you by any chance tried fitting your data to a constant entropy analysis, and if so, what comes out?
Yeah, we have looked briefly at whether the data matches to a conservation of entropy. And the difficulty is that our, and I should have mentioned this before, is that our condensate fraction is a little questionable. So we know if there's a condensate there, we know if it's bigger or smaller. However, in our probing, we lose about half of the atoms due to the finite temperature of the finite lifetime of the molecules. So about half the molecules disappear, then we measure the condensate fraction. So we cannot rule out that the condensate fraction would be higher. It would need to be higher in order to conserve entropy.
Yeah, Debbie, I have a question. The fast sweep, why can you do it backwards? Just a fast sweep to the molecular side to no interaction very quickly, yes?
Yes.
Because then your initial density profile would correspond to these paired states or whatever. And yes. That then that density now would ballistically expand without interaction.
Yes.
Can you do that?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a very interesting idea, and it points out the new possibilities in these experiments that actually I think have not been fully exploited theoretically, because people didn't imagine a tool where you could vary the interactions in real time. So we're sort of exploiting that just to see the condensate, but you're right, there are other experiments you can do where to suddenly move and then look at the response of the system would be very interesting.
Okay. Other comments or questions? Alan.
This is just practice since I get my chance later. I was going to ask a very elementary question, just maybe from a condensed matter physics background, namely, say we're below, we're in the BEC region, as you define it. If we're usually in condensed matter physics, or you're talking about a phase, the properties of the phase are determined by, you just study the properties of that system in equilibrium. Well, here it seems, for instance, let me just talk about the molecular Bose condensate, which I think is equally interesting to the fermion. Well, you have to do this business of ramping to produce the molecules and to produce the Bose condensate and all this sort of stuff. Why can't one simply sneak up on the system when it's at a field below the B0 and say, gotcha, there already is a molecular Bose condensate. Why do you have to somehow do these clever rampings and all that sort of stuff? Like, why, when we study a superconductor, we I guess produce a superconductor, but it's sitting there and then we can measure it.
Well, so I think people are doing experiments where they're creating the condensate on either side and looking at the properties of that. Yeah. We're not doing that in this experiment, and one of your questions was why. When we tried to look just in equilibrium, we expanded the atoms, we simply didn't see any dramatic signature, and we realized we were just looking at individual fermions, and we needed to look at pairs.
So I'm just talking about the molecular Bose condensate. I'm not interested right now.
So the molecular Bose condensate, we do the same experiment. So our experiment is the same on both sides of the phase diagram. On that side, we don't have to talk about it so much because all we're doing is making the molecules tighter bound before we image. So we are moving away from the Fetchbach resonance to image. We find that if we image close to the Fetchbach resonance, the mean field energy and the expansion makes it difficult to see the two-component nature of the condensate plus thermal.
So all this ramping, then, you just view as sort of the way, a way of producing the system, and in principle, if it could live long enough, that it could be stable, you could study it.
Oh, yeah. So the only studies we've done are we've looked at lifetime of the system. But I think other people will report on studies.
Without that?
Yeah, exactly.
I guess we'll have one more question because we really need to move on then. Dan?
Yeah. I have two questions. One is you were implying that you could reduce your data to this parameter KFA. And I wonder how much you can vary KF to see that the region in magnetic field where the thing spills over into the Fermi side varies according to that. A second question is, I'm confused about length scales. Maybe this is just a generic Fetchbach resonance question, but you have the effective range of the potential. You also have the size of the molecular state in the closed channel, and do they play any role?
Okay, so on the second question, where we do our experiments, the size of the molecule is much larger than the effective range or size of the closed channel molecule. So we're really looking at molecules that are very much open channel character with a little bit of closed channel mixed in, because that's our tuning parameter. The first question was... we haven't done explicit studies of this. However, in experiments we have more or less incidentally varied it over a small range. But I think for our lowest, to get to our lowest temperatures, it's hard to vary things as we're sort of pushing the limit. At higher temperatures, we could probably vary it some.
Okay, let's thank Debbie again.